John uses the word sign to mean something more than just a miracle Jesus performed. For John, a sign, to be a sign, needs to point to the identity of Jesus. It needs to introduce us to the new kind of life that Jesus offers us, and it needs to elicit our trust in Jesus. The third sign in the book of signs in the Gospel of John involves the healing of a paraplegic on the Sabbath. The story of this miraculous sign takes place through six different scenes. So let's examine each one in turn and see what it says about the identity of Jesus or the kind of life he offers or the nature of the invitation for us to place our faith in Jesus. The first scene gives us the setting. Jesus is in Jerusalem for one of the festivals. John doesn't tell us which one. Like his counterpart, Luke, John affirms in his gospel that Jesus was active in the expressions of faith of his day. It was not a grim duty that he joined in these things, but a delight to worship God with his own people. All right, then John tells us, inside the city near the sheep gate was the pool of Bethesda with five covered porches. For a long time, people in the modern era had no idea what John was talking about. This was because they could not identify the pool or even the porches. John tells us it was called Bethesda. That's the popular pronunciation of this word. An alternative and possibly more likely pronunciation is Bethzatha. Can you imagine if you lived in Bethesda, Maryland, and suddenly they passed an ordinance that it was going to be called Bethzatha? You can't even say it, Bethzatha, Maryland. But whether it was Bethesda or Bethzatha, where was it? How come nobody knew where this pool was? Many critics assumed that John fabricated this story. Perhaps he intended it to be a fable with a moral lesson attached to it, much like Aesop's fables. Then archaeologists, who are always messing things up, destroying popular beliefs, archaeologists were digging near St. Anne's Monastery in the old city of Jerusalem. And they found what looked like two pools with four porches, and then they found a fifth porch that connected the two pools. And this was near the sheep gate, called that because sheep and other animals were brought through that gate for the sacrifices in the temple. So this was not an idealized legend. This was not a fable. Although John writes after Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans in AD 70, he shows a remarkable recollection of the site. Like the other gospel writers, his was a historically based proclamation of Jesus. He's not making this stuff up. Somewhere along the line, this pool gained the reputation for having healing waters. You may have noticed that verse 4 is missing from our text. Paul did not read it. You did not see it on the screen. And most English translations of the Bible do not have it. This is because the oldest copies of the manuscript do not have it. It seems like at a later time, when someone was copying this, a scribe, they thought, well, I bet people have no idea what's going on here. I mean, I heard this story that people believed there was an angel who would come down once in a while, would stir up the waters, and then the first one in gets healed. And he put it down. But like I said, that was much later, and it's not highly unlikely that it was in the original text. Well, in any case, whatever the reason, it does seem like superstition. But there were many such sites in the ancient world, and there are even some places like that today. And each one has a large gathering of desperate people. In the second scene, we have Jesus coming up to a man who had been ill for 38 years and asking, would you like to get well? On the face of it, that seems like a pretty dumb question. We would expect the man to give a resounding yes, followed by a sound akin to duh. But the sad truth is, not everyone wants to get better. Now, I'm not necessarily talking about physical ailments. Sometimes we get so used to our problems and come to rely upon them as excuses that we really don't want things to change. As an older therapist once said, some people would be very unhappy if you made them happy. But if you want the power of Jesus in your life, then you need to have an intense desire for it. Jesus asks you, do you really want to be changed? And if in your heart of hearts you're content with the way things are, then there will be no change. The man does not really give an answer. Instead, he offers a complaint. I can't, sir, for I have no one to put me in the pool when the water bubbles up. Someone else always gets there ahead of me. Jesus tells him, stand up. Pick up your mat and walk. Most astonishingly, the man is healed, takes up his sleeping mat, and walks. I say astonishingly because this is one of those healing miracles that Jesus performed without any sign of faith on the part of the beneficiary. A reminder that God's favor toward us is a gift that cannot be earned, not even by professed faith. It's also a reminder that just because the body has been healed, doesn't mean the soul has also. The fourth of the Ten Commandments clearly states that we are to remember the Sabbath day. John points out that this healing miracle took place on the Sabbath. No work was to be done on the Sabbath. So here in the third scene, The religious leaders see the man carrying his sleeping mat and say, "You can't work on the Sabbath. The law doesn't allow you to carry that sleeping mat." The man responds by saying that he's only doing what the person who healed him told him to do. When asked who was the one who healed him, the man says he doesn't know. The religious leaders of the day, heavily influenced by a group called the Pharisees, you've probably heard of them before, the Pharisees, a particular religious party within Judaism, had lots of rules about what you could or could not do on the Sabbath. You were not supposed to do work on the Sabbath, but in addition to ordinary employment, they defined other kinds of work in the most extraordinary ways. Carrying a burden, writing a letter, or healing someone, all forbidden. So they spent endless hours arguing whether a person could lift a lamp and put it on the other side of the room on the Sabbath, or whether a tailor committed a terrible sin if he stepped outside his home and he still had a sewing needle in his garment, or if a woman could wear a wig, or a man a set of false teeth or an artificial limb on the Sabbath. They even debated whether it was permissible for a father to lift up his child on the Sabbath. Jesus dismissed all these extra rules. They were not taken from Scripture, but from the oral tradition kept by the Pharisees. Jesus and his disciples walked on the Sabbath, picked heads of grain on the Sabbath. Jesus even healed people on the Sabbath, which is why the Pharisees are so angry in this case. Then in the fourth scene, Jesus runs into this man in the temple. He makes an unnerving observation to the man. "Now you are well, so stop sinning, or something even worse may happen to you." Warning the man that something may happen to him, Jesus might have meant he would suffer a worse physical affliction than the one from which he was delivered. But this seems unlikely. As we will see in a few weeks, specifically March 11th, so be sure to come back that day, Jesus rejects the popular idea that every sickness is linked to a specific sin. Rather, in this case, I think Jesus is warning the man about a moral or spiritual malady, which would be even worse than the physical ailment from which he was delivered. Now, Jesus does find him in the temple. So some people look at that and say, well, he's there because he's obviously grateful to God for what has happened to him. But is he? Nothing else the man says or does corroborates this. He may have just been walking through the outer courts. After all, in any given day here in Battle Creek, a great many people walk across our parking lot, walking across our parking lot to someplace else, completely indifferent to the church the parking lot serves. So yes, the man could now walk around. He could even take a shortcut through the outer courts of the temple. But his life had not changed in any real way. He was the same, the exact same, on the inside. In the fifth scene, this becomes even more apparent. The man whom Jesus heals shows no sign of faith in Jesus, expresses no gratitude for what Jesus has done for him. When confronted by the religious authorities about carrying his sleeping mat on the Sabbath, he deflects blame to the man who healed him. It's his fault. Whose name, by the way, he never bothers to learn until later. And when he meets Jesus again and does learn his name, what does he do? He rats him out to the authorities. Perhaps the man thinks that if the authorities go after Jesus, they will leave him alone. This man's behavior is also a clue for why John would want to include this story in his gospel. John elsewhere says that there were many, many such stories. But he's only put a handful in his gospel, only seven in the section we call the Book of Signs. So why this one? Well, if we remember that John wrote his gospel at a time when the church was being persecuted by officials from the Roman Empire, it makes a little more sense. Some people were leaving the church and betraying their previous sisters and brothers in Christ by going to the authorities, mimicking the actions of the man at the pool of Bethesda. They, like the man, were recipients of the goodness of Jesus, but they did not allow this goodness to change them from within. In the sixth and final scene, we see the religious authorities interrogate Jesus. Or is it the other way around? If we were to look at the rest of the chapter, chapter 5, the whole thing feels like a courtroom scene. And at first, Jesus is in the dock. But by the end of the section, it is clear the religious authorities, and by extension, you and me, are in the dock. But for our purposes today, let's just focus on this point John is trying to make about the identity of Jesus. Who is Jesus? The religious leaders are angry that Jesus broke the Sabbath rules. No one is to work on the Sabbath. What about God? Is God allowed to work on the Sabbath? Ancient rabbis debated that at length. Eventually, they came to the conclusion, yes, God does have a right to work on the Sabbath. I suppose they might have been motivated by the idea that the one who runs the entire universe can't afford to miss even one day of work if the rest of us want to stick around. So yes, God's allowed to work on the Sabbath. In response to the criticism of him, Jesus says, "My Father is always working, and so am I." The Pharisees were not amused. In the English translation, it looks like the religious authorities are angry because Jesus referred to God as his Father. But actually, that's secondary. The reason they were livid was because they understood Jesus to say, because God has a right to work on the Sabbath, so do I. The Pharisees thought this was utter blasphemy. But But it's not blasphemy if it's true, which is precisely John's point. So, what does the miraculous sign of the healing of the paraplegic at the pool of Bethesda say to us? This sign shows us a Jesus far greater than any prophet. This sign shows us a life far greater than external changes. This sign shows us a faith far greater than superstition and man-made religion. I ask you now to turn in your bulletins to the personal prayer preparation for worship that begins the order of service. This is available every Sunday, and we hope that you use this to prepare for worship. But now I'm going to ask us to think about what I just said about this man from Bethesda, and then say this prayer in unison, saying, Jesus, when your compassionate eyes fell upon a pitiful man and you gave him back his life, a life long since surrendered to passivity that could now burst forth with fresh goodness, yet instead of gratitude and honor, you received only silence and tattling. Were your eyes compassionate still? Yes, indeed. For they looked down through the centuries, saw me, and did it again.